So it's a great pleasure to have Matthew Fisher visiting us today from AIIT. Matthew is an extremely distinguished condensed matter theorist who tries to appear not so distinguished. So Matthew spent about 10 years working at IDEA before he moved to the AIIT, where he was one of the prominent members there. Matthew has won several awards during his career. He's won the McMillan Prize. He also received the Initiatives in Research Prize from the National Academy of Sciences, and he was recently elected to be a member of the National Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's worked on a variety of things. So one of his main interests has been the high temperature superconductivity, but he also works on a variety of other things, such as one-dimensional Luttiger liquids. So he made a lot of contributions, also in the quantum Hall effect. They basically suggested the noise experiments as a way to identify the quasi-particle charge. And also I must mention that Matthew comes from a family which includes distinguished people like Michael Fisher, and as a result, he had to basically decided that instead of thinking about particles like everybody was thinking, he decided to go and think about vortices. So while everybody was thinking about where the wave function is peak, roughly speaking, Matthew spent a lot of time thinking about where the wave function is zero, and that led to a lot of new insights from basically very different angles. So,
Okay, well, thank you very much, Arun, for an overly generous introduction. It's certainly a pleasure to be visiting Toronto, and I haven't been here for a number of years. To see the young new additions to the department, and it looks like an exciting place to be. So I look forward to hearing about a lot of great science coming out of University of Toronto. So what I'd like to tell you a little bit about is really just to try to convey to you some of the excitement that's going on in the electronic property of solids. In particular, there's been a standard paradigm for treating electronic motion in solids, which has its roots back to really the development of quantum mechanics, 1930 or so, when Sommerfeld developed the free electron gas theory. The quantum theory of solids has been tremendously successful for understanding many, many different types of materials, insulators, semiconductors, even superconductors, and in some sense underlies, the technological revolution, all our computers and so forth. But it's become increasingly clear, really, in the last couple decades that there are large classes of materials, crystalline solids, which are bad actors. They fall outside of the standard paradigm of solid-state physics. And what some of us believe is that we really are faced with such a severe challenge in understanding these materials that we have to develop some sort of new paradigm. And, a number of us, or, many of us in the field are sort of grappling towards a new understanding of what are called strongly interacting many electron systems. And, sort of the theoretical state of situation is still pretty muddled. But there's some rather exciting ideas floating around out there. And one of the challenges is to really try to make contact with some of the extremely puzzling and interesting experiments which have been ongoing. So I want to give you a little bit of a feeling for how at least the field looks like from my point of view. Again, we're going to be focusing on electrons inside crystals, and the kind of amazing thing about electrons inside ordinary solids is that one's dealing with a system where the quantum mechanics is operative even at room temperature. So it's, there's nothing really exotic about the systems we're thinking about. There's ordinary solids, really. We're just asking about what's going on inside those solids. And I've already mentioned the quantum theory of solids, and the basic notion behind this, as I will amplify in a moment, is that to a reasonably good approximation, you could ignore the fact that the electrons interact with one another. Essentially, every electron kind of does its own thing. It just avoids the other electrons via the Pauli exclusion principle, but that's about it. And what seems clear, then, due to these new experiments that I'll just mention a little bit about, is that the interactions between the electrons are playing a qualitatively important role and have to really be integrated into a correct theoretical framework. And to give a sort of a picturesque way of thinking about it, which was originally sort of put forward by Xiaogan Wen, one of the leaders in this field at MIT, some of you might know, was that the electrons, when they're interacting with one another inside a solid, have to do some sort of cooperative motion, cooperative dancing motion. And that's the title here. My talk is about it's quantum choreography. And as we shall see, I mean, basically the goal of the theoretical physicists, at least, is to try to guess the choreography, the rules that are underlying the motion of 10 to the 23 electrons dancing around quantum mechanically inside a solid. Anyway, please interrupt and ask questions if there are any, very much like that. So again, electrons in solids, one has the atoms, the crystalline periodic rate of ions, if you will, and the electrons, which are tightly bound to the nucleus. What's of interest to the electronic properties of solids are the outer shell of electrons, which in some situations can be mobile, moving through the solids and giving rise to electrical conduction, for example, in simple metals like copper. The energy scales are huge for these electrons moving around in solids. The basic lattice spacing is 3 angstroms, so the kinetic energy, the zero-point kinetic energy of an electron, you know, localized around one atom, is basically, you know, p squared over 2m, but the mass of the electron is so small, there's a huge energy scale of the order of electron volts, or 10 to the 4th degrees Kelvin, much larger than room temperature. Likewise, the Coulomb interaction between two electrons sitting on two neighboring atoms, E squared divided by the distance between them, is itself a huge number comparable to the kinetic energy, again, much bigger than room temperature. Okay, so the interest in trying to understand solids is then trying to understand the quantum dynamics of, you know, 10 to the 23 electrons moving around. And since one is focusing on, let's say, what's happening at room temperatures, or perhaps even lower than room temperatures, and room temperature is much below the characteristic energy scale, in some sense, one's interested in, you know, the ground state properties of these interacting electrons. One can interested on energy scales much below the characteristic energy scales. And that's partly what makes the problem so challenging. Okay, so the standard paradigm, sort of the quantum theory of solids, at this stage, I think it's one can view it as resting on two great pioneering works of Lev Landau's, well-known Russian physicist. And the first is Landau-Fermi liquid theory, which together with band theory accounts for the electronic behavior of simple metals, insulators, and semiconductors. And then Landau's other theory, his theory of phase transition, provides a framework to understand how, for example, simple metals can have instabilities towards ferromagnetism or superconductivity. And just to, you know, remind you in a nutshell, I imagine most of you have seen this a number of times, sort of the standard quantum theory of solids, the main players, of course, then are the electrons. The most important term in the Hamiltonian and the energetics is just the kinetic energy, p squared over 2m. Pauli exclusion means you fill up the lowest kinetic energy states. In momentum space, you have then the filled states up to the Fermi energy, up to the Fermi momentum, Fermi surface. And the low energy excitations are you take an electron out of this filled Fermi C and you give it a bit of energy and promote it to just outside the Fermi C. And that's a particle hole excitation. And those particle hole excitations can carry, you know, electrical current in a metal and give conduction. Now, of course, the electrons, in addition to having kinetic energy, interact with one another through the Coulomb interaction. And what Landau realized, essentially, is that even with interactions present, this basic picture of Fermi surface is maintained. One still has a Fermi surface, and indeed the volume of that Fermi surface is the same as it would be if you didn't have any interaction between the electrons. And perhaps even more important is that when these particle hole excitations have a low energy with respect to the Fermi energy, when they're sort of just excited above the Fermi energy, due to phase space restrictions, there's not much room, there are not many states available for the two electrons to scatter into, not very many final states, excuse me. So the scattering rate, the decay rate of this electron cascading down in energy as it knocks into all the other electrons, vanishes as the square of the energy of that electron. So at low energies, these electronic excitations behave more and more like free particle excitations, even though, you know, ultimately the theory is interacting. So that's Landau-Fermi liquid theory. All the interesting physics of solids really comes when you add the periodic potential that the electrons see from the crystalline ions. And of course, as you know, plane waves become block states. You then get, you know, forbidden energies, energy gaps, energy bands, and so forth. And you know, at first blush, the electrical properties of solids are determined by whether you have filled electronic bands or not. If you have filled bands, then you have a band insulator. If you have partially filled bands, band theory would say that you have a metallic state. So in particular, if you have an even number of electrons per unit cell, oftentimes, although not always, you have a band insulator, you have filled bands. On the other hand, if you have an odd number of electrons per unit cell, band theory would say that you always have a metal, you always have a partially filled band, and there are states in that band for the electrons to move around in. Okay, so that's the basic picture of Landau theory and band theory. And finally, using this approach, one can understand the other phases besides metals and insulators that one has, such as superconductors and ferromagnets and antiferromagnets and spin density waves and wave states and so forth, as having instability of the metallic phase due to the development of some sort of order, an order parameter one can define, which is basically a local observable which is non-zero in one phase and zero in the other. That's all the order parameter is. And take a big example, in electrons in a metal moving around, there's an order parameter for the superconducting phase, which is you just destroy two electrons with opposite spin, and the order parameter for the ferromagnet is given here. And basically, Landau said that you can take these order parameters and develop sort of a free energy functional, which allows you to study the instabilities of the metal as it becomes unstable to the development of superconductivity. BCS theory is, in some sense, an example of a Landau-Ginzburg type theory. It's slightly more complicated, but it's in the same spirit, really, for the development of superconductivity coming out of a metal. Okay, so in a nutshell, then, band theory, Fermi liquid theory, band theory, and Landau's theory works, again, tremendously well for many, many materials. And basically, it works well for materials in which the electrons which are moving around in the solid have an atomic S or P character. That is, the electrons are coming from atomic S or P shells. And so, for example, the simple noble metals, copper, gold, and silver, it's one electron in the 4S shell, which can move very easily from copper to copper atom and then conducts electricity very nicely. The semiconductors such as silicon and germanium, there are four electrons per unit cell, but there are four orbitals, 1S orbital, 3P orbitals. And again, one can understand, the semiconductor, very nicely within band theory. Likewise, a band insulator, which is a larger band gap than in the semiconductor, such as diamond. So here, band theory really works. But now, where band theory doesn't work so well, and in fact, oftentimes qualitatively breaks down, is when one's dealing with crystalline solids in which the electrons which are moving around, or the electrons at the Fermi energy, if you will, have an atomic D or F shell character. And what happens is when you have atomic D or F shell electrons, those electrons are actually closer into the nucleus relative to the size of the atom, which can be set by SOP, electron orbitals. And so these D or F shell electrons, even though they're at the highest energy, they're rather localized on their respective nuclei, so it's hard for them to hop from one atom to the other. And because of this, the kinetic energy of the electrons in these situations, when they have an atomic D or F character, is greatly suppressed. And so relative to the Coulomb interaction, one's dealing, in fact, with a system where, where the important energy scale in some sense is the interaction, and the kinetic energy is perhaps of less importance. And so that's the opposite of the situation in simple SOP systems like a copper, where it's really the kinetic energy, which is the dominant energy, which gives the motion of the electrons. So examples of materials with DOF shell electrons are, for example, the high-temperature superconductors, the best-studied example of all. But that's the tip of the iceberg. Many other transition metal oxides, manganates, chlorides, bromides, and so forth, have partially filled 3D or 4D bands. And then there's a large classes of material called rare earth, the heavy fermium-like materials, which have 4F or 5F bands, which are partially filled. Okay, and what can happen in these situations can be qualitatively different, or so we believe, than what happens in band theory. Now, what some of us are hoping might happen, and what's in some sense one of the most interesting scenarios, is that when one has strong Coulomb interactions between the electrons, which are more important than the kinetic energy of the electrons, one hopes for something like electron fractionalization. So let me tell you what electron fractionalization is, tell you where it occurs, and tell you where it might occur. And where it might occur is really the focus of the, you know, the current theory in this area. So what electron fractionalization is the following. If you take a system of, let's say, 10 to the 23 electrons, and you cool it down to zero temperature, there's some ground state, and then you can knock the system and excite some particles out of the ground state. And if you have an electron fractionalized system, what will happen is that the ground state will be such a complicated, you know, configuration of all the electrons that the excited states, although they look like particles, they carry quantum numbers which are fractional. That is, they carry quantum numbers which cannot be built from those of individual electrons, namely charge E and spin a half. So, for example, a Cooper pair a superconductor is not really fractionalized. A Cooper pair is charged 2E and spin zero, and is basically two electrons put together. So this electron fractionalization is a relatively old idea, actually, and particularly in the context of one-dimensional systems. At least, you know, roots are traced back some 50 years, but I think it's really appreciated only in the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. But the place where electron fractionalization definitely does occur, both in theoretical models and experimentally as measured, are in one-dimensional system of electrons. If you can find electrons to move in one dimension, as one can do in quantum wires and semiconductors, one can do in carbon nanotubes. It's very nice one-dimensional molecules. And there, this phenomenon of electron fractionalization occurs and has been observed, those particular signatures, experimental signatures. Another place where electron fractionalization occurs is if you take two electrons localized at the interface between two different types of semiconductors, you have a very thin layer of two-dimensional electrons. If you cool them, those electrons down to very low temperatures, but on a very strong magnetic field, you enter into the regime of the so-called fractional quantum hole effect. And the fractional, of course, refers to the fractionalization of the electronic excitations. Okay, what I'm interested in exploring, and which is really at the forefront, I think, of this evolving field, is can we find ground states of electronic systems in which the electrons fractionalize in ordinary crystals, not in one-dimensional crystals, not in materials in which one has enormous magnetic fields on, just in ordinary crystals in ordinary situation, and two or three-dimensional systems, can we find something with electron fractionalization? Okay, so this is in some sense a bit of a holy grail, and it's extremely challenging. Now, where one might look to find this? Well, the place to look is really in these materials with d or f shell electrons. And what happens in such materials is that one often gets something which is called a Mott insulator. Okay, and so a Mott insulator, named after Neville Mott, English physicist who died a few years back, is a quantum arrangement of electrons which exists because of the Coulomb interaction between the electrons. In some sense, it's rather simple. So in particular, let me define it as an insulating material with an odd number of electrons per unit cell. So let's say one electron per unit cell. Band theory, the standard paradigm, would say that you have a partially filled band and you have a metal. But in real materials, what can happen is that due to the Coulomb effects between the electrons, that the electrons can essentially self-localize on their respective atoms. Now, what I've written down here is sort of the simplest, model of electrons hopping around the sites of a lattice, viewed as, the sites of each atom. There's a kinetic energy, and then there's a Coulomb interaction, which is, described in extremely simplistic terms in this so-called Hubbard model, which many of you have probably seen. And the key point, though, is if you have strong Coulomb repulsion between the electrons, and up and down spin electrons don't like sitting on the same site. They don't like sitting on the same atom, just through the Coulomb repulsion. And if that repulsive energy is sort of stronger than the kinetic energy, this hopping strength T, then one can sometimes freeze into one of these Mott insulators. Okay, so in particular, if you have the situation with one electron per unit cell and a very strong repulsion between the electrons, the electrons just give up. So this electron, it doesn't want to hop onto the neighboring sites because there's such a strong repulsion, so it just kind of stays where it is, more or less. So you might have thought this, Mott insulator is very simple, actually. You just have one electron per site. Now, what makes it not so simple is that the electrons have a spin, and so those spins can be up or down. And so, in fact, there's a very rich quantum mechanics now have these spin degrees of freedom fluctuating around, spin one half for an electron, very quantum mechanical spin, flipping back and forth. Now, there's a basic interaction between spins, which in these Mott insulators is anti-ferromagnetic, so neighboring spins like to anti-align with one another. And the physics of this is very simple. It's just that if you have two electrons on two neighboring atoms, that if the spins are anti-aligned, then you can hop this electron onto this atom. It costs energy, but it's allowed by Pauli, and then you can hop it back again. Or you can hop this one back. And so, whereas if the spins are the same of the two electrons, you can't hop one on top of the other because of Pauli exclusion. So there's basically an anti-ferromagnetic interaction, which is called an anti-ferromagnetic exchange interaction. And so trying to understand, in fact, this Heisenberg-Hamiltonian for these spin systems gives one a situation where things are a little simpler than in materials which are electrically conducting, where the electrons are moving around. But it's still nevertheless quite complicated. So perhaps the best studied example of a Mott insulator are the high-temperature superconductors, which I'm sure you've all heard about almost probably ad nauseum. But indeed, the undoped parent compounds of the high-temperature superconductors have a square lattice of copper atoms, and essentially you can think of each copper atom as having one electron on them. And the electron spins can point up or down, and in this phase diagram, which I'm sure you've all seen many times, temperature versus the number of electrons that you take out of this copper oxygen sheet, or equivalently the number of holes you put in, what one finds is that the high temperature superconductivity develops once you've taken out 5 or 10% of the electrons. And there's this very interesting regime in here, the so-called pseudo gap, which is still quite mysterious, which I'll perhaps come back to shortly. Okay, so now what I want to do is to try to give you a bit of a flavor, sort of a cartoon understanding of electron fractionalization, which probably a number of you have seen, so just bear with me. But this cartoon came to me, it's not really a cartoon, a way of thinking about it, when I was single. About 5 years ago, I got divorced, and I became single as a middle-aged man. And so I actually started socializing with people besides physicists, and go to parties, and, invariably, people would ask, what do you do, And, if you're a physicist at a party with people that aren't physicists and they ask you what you're doing, you're in trouble, right, basically. So you have to think of some answer. And so I'd usually say, well, I work at the university. And they go, yeah. the next is I teach, okay? I teach science, okay? And usually the conversation ends by then, And so then, very occasionally you get someone who's actually genuinely interested in what you're doing, and they want to, hear that you do physics. What type of physics? Oh, it's not string theory. That's usually the response. But, they know everything about string theory, let me tell you. So, much more than I do. And so they say, but if it's not string theory, what is it? Well, I said, let me try to tell you. And another thing, another reaction I get, which is they say, well, what do you do for your creative outlet? Okay, so we have a communication problem with the general public out there, I think, and it basically makes it apparent. So I tried to think of a simple way I could describe, what I actually did in physics. So I had this analogy, which is, imagine you live in a town, and there's a town hall in the middle of town, and every Friday night there's a, big dance where they're, men and women are dressed up and they're going in and you can hear music and it looks like a big party. I mean, it is a big party going on in there, but you're underage, so they don't let you in. Your goal is to try to figure out what's going on inside that dance hall without going inside, okay? And you have to, in particular, figure out, what kind of dance they're doing. What's the choreography? Are they doing square dancing? Are they doing ballet? Are they doing, what are they doing? You want to figure this out. Well, there's various sort of experiments you could try to do. I mean, you could, put your head against the wall and listen to the music. You could look at the statistics of the men and women going in the front door and out the back door. If you're an experimentalist, you really want to take the bull by the horns, you could, take a bunch of men and women and push them in the front door you know, and measure how quickly they come at the back door, or you could just push in men and see how quickly the women run out the other side. You know, spin resolve transport or whatever it is. You could do tunneling. You could drop people through the skylight. You could listen to the screaming as they join the dance floor. You know, you could do lots of experiments like this. And through these, you'd have to try to guess, you know, what the dance is, right? And it's actually not that easy, if you think about it. And it's more complicated, of course, if you're in this quantum world, because we're trying to guess what the electrons are doing, what their dance pattern is. And they're doing some sort of quantum dance, and, you know, we can't get inside that dance hall. I mean, indirectly, we can, you know, push electrons in, we can shoot neutrons off, we can shoot X-rays off, we can, you know, tunnel electrons in, and so forth. So one has to do some sort of quantum choreography, and a bit the way you would have to do it, I think, at this stage, is you'd have to try to make some guesses as to what type of dance you think might be going on just from the basic, you know, experimental facts that you might have at hand. You know, so you might guess, are they square dancing? Well, you understand square dancing, and so you listen to it. Does the beat sound right, and so forth? You know, maybe they're not. Maybe they're doing some other kind of dance. Maybe it's an entirely new dance that you don't know, and in fact, that's, you know, what many of us strongly suspect in these interesting materials. So let me just show how that would work in the context of electrons. At the risk of being politically incorrect, let me just imagine that we have the dance floor, which is a square lattice, and, you know, men and women, up and down spin electrons can, you know, occupy this dance floor. And the rules for electrons are not that different than the rules that dictate social behavior of people, really. Now, I don't know about Canada, but in the United States, almost everyone's a homophobe. Particularly, you know, our election a few years back, you know. So basically, for a physicist, that's Pauli exclusion. You know, two men just don't sit on top of each other, and it just doesn't happen. And in addition, electrons, like people, are basically shy. They try to avoid one another, really. I mean, you know, there's a bit of a repulsion. You know, so the simplest dance, if you will, that one could imagine, which is hardly dancing at all, is just men and women line up on a checkerboard in this way. Okay, very boring. But like people, electrons do actually like to dance. They have a kinetic energy. They like moving around as well. And so the simplest move they can do is you can just take a man and a woman next to each other, and they can exchange positions and exchange back again. Now, for those of you who have done square dancing, I don't know, in Canada, maybe no one square dances. I'm not sure what the dances are in Canada. But square dances, you take a man and a woman, and they just, you know, they do-si-do. They go around one another like this. And so the quantum version of that do-si-do is what the chemists would call a chemical bond, what the physicists called a valence bond, or a singlet bond. And it's basically, you know, up and down spin electron, you know, tunneling back and forth. And so that's, you know, up, down, minus, down, up. That's a singlet. So let me just denote that as a, you know, a purple bar. You know, you basically, if they're going around quickly enough, you kind of don't, you know, you don't see them. You just know they're dancing. And so a particularly, you know, boring type of dance, which is a little more interesting than people just standing there with their hands in their pockets, is each person just grabs a neighbor and starts dancing. And they do it in such a way that they've organized themselves into this pattern here. Now, this is called a valence bond crystal, and indeed, in some materials, this is what happens. Electrons do form singlets, which crystallize. But electrons, really, are just like people. Sometimes they get bored dancing with the same partner for too long, and so they like to swing. And so you can get four electrons which are dancing with, you know, partners across like this, and then they can say, well, we might want to switch, you know, switch back and forth. It's definitely much more fun. Okay, so they can resonate. And the more exciting, though, is what you can have is the quantum version of when in square dancing is called the grand right and left. The grand right and left is where you essentially switch position with your partner, then you switch position with your the partner of the man next to you, and then the next partner. And so as you go around the dance floor, you basically take a turn dancing with, you know, everybody of the opposite sex throughout the whole dance floor, you know, which is a great thing, really, particularly if you don't like your partner. But and so the quantum version of this, the quantum grand right and left, is what Phil Anderson, you know, the guru in this field, called the resonating valence bond state. Okay, so you start with everybody, you know, paired up in some sort of rather boring way, and then you start switching partners around. Oops, let me actually get this straight. I'm going the wrong way here. Sorry about that. Giving away. So, okay, so you have people just dancing around, switching partners, And what you have is a liquid of pairs. Okay, so it's like a fluid of these valence bonds. It turns out that's a very interesting quantum mechanical state when you describe this quantum, when you describe the full quantum mechanics. And it's interesting in particular when you start considering breakups, you know, just like people, you get kind of tired dancing with the same person, or you argue with your wife, whatever. So people stop, these two people stop dancing, you know, and then once, you know, once everyone else on the dance floor is dancing and switching partners, you're just standing there, you feel a little bit ill at ease, and so you separate and you start heading off the dance floor. And this is rather interesting in this quantum state because now you have, you know, what was a pair dancing is now two separate spins, and these are actually called spin-ons, and what you have here, which is extremely interesting actually, even though it's rather simple pictorially, is an excitation locally here and here, which carry the spin of the electron, spin up or spin down, but don't carry any electrical charge. That is, they don't carry any electrical charge with respect to the average charge density in the system, which is one electrical charge per site. And in some descriptions, these spin-ons are fermions. So these spin-ons have the spin of the electron, spin up, and no charge. And so this is sort of a two-dimensional example of, you know, sort of cartoon of electron fractionalization. Sometimes called spin-charge separation, because you have the electron spin can move around as a well-defined excitation, but the electron charge is not moving with it. You know, things are more interesting, in fact, if you, you know, after you get, you split up like this, you sometimes get, you know, feel dejected, and then you might get, you might say, I'm going home. And what gets left behind are two holes, places where these dancers were. These are called holons. These are interesting excitations because they, relative to the background, they carry charge plus E, the same charge, you know, the opposite charge of an electron. But there's no spin there. All the spins are paired up with the neighboring spins. So these are charge E, spin zero, and in some descriptions are bosons. So again, one has electron charge but no spin. Again, an example of electron fractionalization. And one of the reasons this idea that Phil Anderson put forward was exciting in the context of the high-temperature superconductors, which is where he, not where he originally put it forward, but where he, you know, was really pushing for it, is that it gives one a rather simple way to understand superconductivity. In particular, if these holons, which are charged and are bosonic, can move around easily, they can possibly condense, they can both condense. And if they do, you in fact go into a superconducting state. In some sense, what is happening here, if you think about superconductivity in this way, rather than taking two electrons and pairing them up to make a Cooper pair and condensing the Cooper pair, what one is doing here is taking an electron, which is a spin one-half fermion with charge E, and the electron is sort of sloughing off its spin and its Fermi statistics, leaving behind its charge, charge E, and it's just boson statistics and no spin. And, you know, the reason fermions can't condense is because they're fermions, but once the electrons lose their Fermi statistics, they can condense directly. And, you know, one might imagine that would be a good way to achieve, you know, high-temperature superconductivity. So this has been a question around for a while, understanding, and theoretically this works out, actually, that if you then take electrons out of one of these RVB spin liquids, these resonating valence bond spin liquids that I was talking about, that is, if you dope, remove electrons, this could be a route to high-temperature superconductivity. You know, so the question is this the route that's actually taken by the cuprates? Okay, well, as some of you probably know, that a few years back, Sentol, who was a postdoc then at UCSB, and myself, we proposed an experiment to try to check whether or not the high-temperature superconductors, in particular pseudo-gap phase, was the simplest type of RVB spin liquid. I'll describe that experiment very quickly. The result was negative. But nevertheless, it's, I think, still interesting, and it conveys perhaps some understanding, further understanding of this, these spin liquids and what they're like. So the question, the approach, the attitude taken was that, you know, by many people in the field, was that, okay, you have these high-temperature superconducting phase diagram, and the undoped material, you know, with one electron per unit cell, which is the Mott insulator, that's a boring antiferromagnet, just up, down, up, down, up, down. But the antiferromagnetic is destroyed once you start removing electrons, and you don't have to remove that many electrons, like 5% or 10% certainly, and you rapidly destroy the antiferromagnet, and then you go into this, you know, very interesting pseudo-gap phase or regime, which is, you know, still rather poorly understood, and which is, you know, one of the holy grails in this field, is trying to understand this sort of blue regime. And then, you know, as you dope more, you go into the superconductor. And the superconducting per se, we understand its properties inside the phase. What we don't understand is the pseudo gap and how you get into the superconductor. So the question, you know, is this pseudo gap phase, this, you know, RVB, resonant valence bond spin liquid, with this fractionalized character that I was talking about, well, that's a well-defined question, you know, but how could one tell? Well, the way one can try to tell is to look for, as we suggested, something called topological order. Let me tell you a little bit what that is. It turns out that in this simplest RVB spin liquid, there's a hidden symmetry, a hidden discrete, what's called a Z2 symmetry, which is, as we'll see, the system is in some sense analogous to electromagnetism. You know, Maxwellian electromagnetism, there are electric charges, and in principle, there could be magnetic monopoles, okay? And there's a U1 gauge symmetry, you know, describing, you know, the Coulomb interactions between the charged particles in nature. But here, inside this RVB spin liquid, there's, in fact, this hidden Z2 gauge symmetry, so that the spinons and holons that we've been talking about carry a sort of fictitious electrical charge, a Z2 electrical charge. But there is a particle, which is called a vison, a bit like a vortex, which carries a magnetic charge, you know, in quotes. It's not a real magnetic field. And indeed, when you take one of these spinons or holons and you take them around the vison, which is a point-like particle in the Z2 spin liquid, the spinons and holons pick up a minus sign, the wave function. The wave function picks up a phase of pi. UVI pi is minus 1. And so what's topologically ordered, what topological order means is something rather abstract, which is that if you take one of these two-dimensional quantum spin liquid phases, and you imagine, you know, putting them on a torus, which is obviously impossible to do in practice. Numerically, on some toy model, you can do that. You can just take periodic boundary conditions in the two directions to make a torus. But if the system is topological order, what happens is that there is a degeneracy of the ground state on the torus. Now, for the Z2 spin liquids, the fourfold degeneracy of the ground state. And basically, the fourfold degeneracy corresponds to whether or not there is a vison through this hole of the torus and through the, you know, other hole inside the torus. Now, there's not the vison is not a magnetic field, so you couldn't actually measure it out here. When I say there's a vison through here, all I mean is that if you take a holon, which is an excitation, which I've already described, and you take that around the hole of this torus, if there, quote, is a vison through there, the phase of the holon wave function picks up a pi. If the phase of the wave function of the holon doesn't pick up a pi, there is no vison. Okay. Now, the very essence of superconductivity, you know, which most of you know is the Meissner effect, is the expulsion of a magnetic field when you cool down a metal into the superconducting phase. Well, the essence of these topologically ordered states, and particularly the Z2 topologically ordered states, is the expulsion of the visons, which are the analogs of the magnetic field, of the Z2 magnetic field. So we suggested this vison detection experiment, and where basically the idea was you take the system in the pseudo gap, and you're trying to test whether the pseudo gap is an RVB spin liquid, and you tune into and out of the superconductor. And so the picture is that when you tune the RVB liquid into the superconductor, what's happening, as I've already mentioned, the holons condense. These charged bosons both condense. What about the spinons, these lone spins? They become the BCS quasiparticles. And what about the visons? The visons become the vortices, the HC over 2E vortices, which you, inside the superconductor you can measure. And in fact, it's that idea which underlie the suggestion of how to, in principle, measure whether or not you have a vison in this system. And so the experiment, which has now been performed, where you take a superconductor with a hole in it, you cool into the superconducting phase in small non-zero magnetic fields so that you trap some magnetic flux, in particular one magnetic flux quantum, through the hole of the cylinder here. And together with that is a vison, in fact, because the vison became the vortex once you tune from the spin liquid into the superconducting state. And now what you do is you heat the material in where it goes normal, where it's no longer superconductor, into the pseudo-gap phase. Now, if the super... And then you turn off the magnetic field, excuse me. If the pseudo-gap phase is in one of these spin liquids in which visons are expelled, then the vison will still remain trapped through the hole, just like magnetic field is, you know, remain trapped through the hole in the first place in the superconductor. And then, so that's how you would prepare the vison, and if it's in this spin liquid phase, the vison stays trapped, and then you'd cool back into the superconductor, and you necessarily would nucleate the magnetic flux quantum, in which you can then measure. And the magnetic flux could be, in fact, in either direction. And so this would be a way to, in principle, determine whether or not the vison got stuck in the hole. Okay, so these experiments were done by Catherine Moeller and Doug Bond out of Vancouver with their collaborators on these beautiful single crystals that Doug Bond grows. And there was a hole drilled into one of these crystals with an ion beam. And anyway, the experiments were done, and what was found when they cycled in and out of the superconductor from the pseudogap phase is that there was no memory effect. The flux, you know, which they started in the hole, when they cooled into the pseudogap and cooled back down again, there was no flux. The visons had gone. Evidently, the visons had escaped. Conclusion, at its most brutal conclusion, is that this pseudogap phase is not the Z2 spin liquid. And I think that's actually, I believe that conclusion. Well, it's a bit disappointing, for those of us who have, been thinking about the Z2 spin liquid. At least the virtue of this experiment is that it was, you could verify it or not, as the case might be. You could rule it out, and it leaves open the question, what is the pseudogap phase? What is the choreography, quantum choreography, going on in the high-temperature superconductors in that pseudogap phase? Okay, so what I want to do in the last 5 or 10 minutes or so is to describe another direction the number of people are going in trying to look experimentally for fractionalized spin liquid type phases. As you recall, then in the high temperature superconductor, in the undoped parent compound where there was one electron per unit cell, the system was in this rather boring antiferromagnet, spin up, spin down, spin up, spin down. And it became interesting, in some sense, once you doped, once you took out electrons, then the magnetism disappeared and you went into some sort of liquid pseudogap phase. So what is a little bit simpler to imagine doing, and one can do by finding different materials, is to destroy the magnetic order, the symmetry breaking, without doping in holes. Okay. And so the way to do that is to move away from the square lattice towards a triangular lattice, for example. If you have a triangular lattice or triangles of three spins which are antiferromagnetically coupled, there's something called frustration, which I'm sure most of you have heard about. That is, these spins would like to anti-align with their neighbors, but that's impossible. These two can anti-align, and then this one doesn't know whether to anti-align with this one or that one. So all nearest neighbor bonds cannot be satisfied simultaneously. There's a sort of frustration going on in the system. Now, even if you have frustration, you can sometimes accommodate it, as is done, in fact, in the simplest of triangular lattices, where the spins choose, rather than pointing, anti-aligned with their nearest neighbor, they kind of compromise and point, sort of 120 degrees away from their neighboring spins. Okay, so the other thing which is, in some sense, interesting and helpful from the point of view of looking for spin liquids is that there are many different types of spin liquids. I described the simplest bare-bones Z2 spin liquid, which, as I said, had topological order. In particular, it had this ground state degeneracy in a torus. It was fractionalization of quantum numbers. One thing I didn't mention, but maybe I can I think it is quite amusing or interesting, is that, I'm sure you've heard a lot about quantum computing, trying to use quantum degrees of freedom to do, something useful, like factorize 15. Or maybe not 21, I guess is the way we can't do it. But a real problem with quantum computing is that quantum systems are very fragile. If you look at them, they collapse. The wave functions literally collapse. So you have to prepare them without sort of looking at them. Let them work while you're looking the other direction, and then look over the right time and see what they've done. And there you are. So that's extremely difficult, right? So there was an amazing suggestion now about 10 years ago made by Alexei Kateyev, who's now at Caltech, which was to use these topologically ordered spin liquid states as a way to perform quantum computation in a robust, decoherence-free environment. And it's a wild but beautiful idea, which in principle is correct. The challenge is in finding topologically ordered spin liquids with large enough in the right parameter regimes at high enough temperatures and so forth. The basic idea in a nutshell is to use excitations like the bison that I was talking about, and maybe have many bisons and be moving them around and braiding them around one another in order to perform the computation. In order to do this, one actually needs topological spin liquids, which are much more complicated than the Zdu spin liquid that I was talking about. In fact, well, in the fractional quantum Hall effect, as you know, very many of you know, you have excitations which carry fractional charge, a bit like the spinons, but they have, in addition to fractional charge, they have fractional statistics. When you exchange them, the wave function doesn't change sign like with fermions, it doesn't stay the same like bosons, it picks up a phase factor, you know, e to the 2 pi I over 3 for Laughlin quasi-particles. Well, it turns out that there are even more exotic type spin liquids of topological order in which the particle excitations, which exist in two dimensions which you can move around, have what's called non-abelian statistics. You know, that is, if you have, let's say, eight particles sitting there and you braid one around the other, what's happened is that there's the Hilbert space is big, and there's a unitary transformation which is done on the Hilbert space when you start braiding these particles. And if you braid the first and the second particle and then the second and the third, the unitary transformation that you get is different than if you braided the second and third and then the first and second. That is, they don't commute. It's non-abelian. So these particles have what's called non-abelian statistics, and you know, they really would be a perfect setting if you could make one of these non-abelian topologically ordered spin liquid states to be able to do real genuine decoherence free quantum computing in a scalable way where you could really perhaps factorize large numbers. What I'm actually interested in now, and as we'll tell you about very, very briefly, are the second class of spin liquids, which in some sense even more exotic than the ones I've just mentioned. In these spin liquids, there is no gap. There's no notion of particle excitations. The whole system is so richly entangled of all these electrons that there are gapless excitations running around, and there are excitations. The excitations that move around don't move around like free particles. There's no free particle description at all. And these states are sometimes called algebraic or critical spin liquids. And if one needs a cartoon of them, the dance floor is even more interesting. What is happening is that in addition to people just dancing with their nearest neighbor and switching and swinging around, you have people whose motion around the dance floor is correlated. In some sense, they're dancing with neighbors arbitrarily far away, right? So it's an extremely complicated, sort of entangled state of people dancing with one another on all different length scales, all at the same time. And that's these critical spin liquids. In fact, a number of us have been interested in this material called cesium copper chloride, including, Yongbek, Kim here in the your department. And one of the reasons is this is a material of triangular lattice of spin a half antiferromagnet. It's a bit like the cuprate, except the copper sheets are triangular lattices rather than square lattices. And in this cesium copper chloride, there's a regime in temperature where it looks like some sort of spin liquid phase. Down at low temperatures below 0.26 Kelvin, the system does magnetically order. It does the rather boring spiral order, or this 120-degree ordering that I mentioned on the triangular lattice. But there is this regime of temperature where it looks like you might have some sort of interesting spin liquid. And in neutron scattering data taken by Radu Kolde and his co-workers, in addition to Bragg peaks at low temperatures, which you can see that there has been long-range magnetic order, what one finds is that there, away from these Bragg peaks, there is a continuum of inelastic scattering. So as a function of frequency, there's like a Powell law, which suggests that there are fluctuations on all energy scales, at least over a range of energies. Equivalently, it suggests that there are fluctuations on all length scales. So I think there's reasonable evidence from this neutron scattering data that perhaps what one's dealing with here is some sort of critical type spin liquid. And in collaboration with my graduate student Jason Alicia and Lazik Motronich, who's a postdoc and just taking up a faculty job at Caltech next year, this fall, we had one particular theoretical proposal called algebraic vortex liquid, which we suggested might be what's perhaps going on in this cesium copper chloride. This algebraic vortex liquid has some of these properties. It's a critical phase with no free particle description, has Powell correlations. It's a stable, what's perhaps most interesting to me is it's a stable gapless phase. So it's, you know, it's very fragile, but you can nevertheless change parameters around over some finite regimes, and it doesn't have an instability in general. It doesn't need to have an instability. Now, in practice, because of spin-orbit interactions which are present in these materials, it does have an instability towards this spiral order. Now, of course, that's what's actually seen in the experiments when a spiral order. So this is, you know, somewhat perhaps encouraging. But the reason I mention this is because it's a system I've, you know, worked on and thought quite a bit about. But there are a number of other examples of what are called frustrated quantum magnets. That is, you know, quantum spins in these mod insulators, which are antifermionically coupled on, let's say, triangular lattices or Kagame lattices. You can have other frustrated lattices. And so then the spins don't know how to order, and they fluctuate around in some, you know, very intricate and rich pattern. And again, one has to try to guess the quantum choreography underlying the spins. Okay, I think I'll skip that. So basically I just want to leave you with the feeling that this is a very exciting time for the, you know, quantum theory of solids. I mean, it's clear that there are many materials, these materials with d or f shell electrons, which at the very least fall outside of band theory. And, you know, most of these materials with one electron of unit cell have are insulating, you know, which band theory would say they shouldn't be. You know, many of them magnetically order, some of them, you know, form valence bond solids and have, you know, structural distortions. And some of them probably have some of these spin liquid phases in them. And so these are, you know, interesting systems to explore to try to, you know, look for, you know, some of these more exotic ideas, like these topological and critical spin liquids. Now, in the context of the Coupe rates, you know, things are even more complicated because rather than these mod insulators where the electrons can't move around, it's just their spins flip around. In the Coupe rates, once you've doped, the electrons can move around, and then, you know, all bets are off. You know, we tried the Z2 spin liquid, that didn't work. You know, what is going on? Well, it's not clear, I think. So then I've been talking a bit about these frustrated antiferromagnets, but let me leave you with, you know, essentially, you know, there is this rich quantum world of, you know, interacting, you know, many-body systems of fermions, and also actually in, you know, these cooled atomic gases where one can has, you know, now it's entering this regime of, you know, correlated atoms, bosonic and fermion atoms in these atom traps that, you know, some of you probably know about. And in these interacting many-body quantum systems, you know, the systems, the particles can, you know, really choose in order to minimize energy to do these rather, you know, interesting and exotic quantum dynamics. And, you know, the challenge then is to really try to guess what they're doing, test what they're doing, you know, and see whether that's what they're actually doing or not. And, you know, I think it's an exciting time, and, you know, hopefully there'll be significant progress in the next, you know, decade or two. So thanks for your attention. Wait, is it Z2 in Canada or is it Z2? Okay, I'm sorry.
Same phase.
Yeah, no, it's the same phase. It's not there in either case.
What's interesting about that example, as you say, quite apart from the simplest possibility, is the fact that there, human sample came up with a really clean, sort of definite experiment that settled it one way or another. And what about some of these other phases, the algebraic, is there also a clean thing that says yes or no?
Yeah, so these algebraic spin liquids in which there are gapless excitations, they're much, on the one hand, more fragile and much more difficult to characterize, and as a result, you know, they're going to be, there's not going to be, I don't think, such a clean experimental indicator. You might say, well, how are we going to tell that that's what's going on? Well, I think we're going to have to find other indirect means, but perhaps the best way to try to tell would be, well, to do the various different probes, but to dope the materials. You know, I think that often tells one about something that's going on, because you know, the charged excitations that one maybe is not probing in the insulator, when you dote, you liberate those. So, for example, in these, you know, there are Z2 spin liquids where the charge carriers, the holons are fermionic, and there's a spin gap. You know, the spinons are bosonic and a gap. And if you could dope, you know, if you had such a material like that and you doped it, what you would, you know, expect is you'd get metallic conduction, but a spin gap. So, you know, there'd be no Pauli susceptibility. Because that would be a pretty robust signature, you know, if it conducted like a metal, but it didn't respond to a magnetic field like a metal. But again, that's one of these topological states which is more robust. But, you know, so that's the challenge in this area, is that these intricate quantum motions are not something which either we have much intuition for or in which our probes are that well designed to look at. You know, the probes that, you know, the probes that we can visualize most easily are the ones that measure spatial modulations, you know, STM, or even scattering experiments. When there's, you know, when something modulated in space, that's something we can understand very well. But what we can't intuit so well is the, you know, phase behavior of these complex wave functions. And that's, you know, where all these intricate correlations are located in some sense. And so it seems to me that one thing that might be helpful is to try to develop more phase-sensitive probes. I mean, we were talking earlier about John Way, about, you know, superconducting STM tips, and, you know, which people are, you know, thinking about developing. And, you know, perhaps there's something there that one can, you know, use the superconducting phase in the tip to probe, you know, phase correlations, you know, on the local scales inside materials, which, you know, might give one insights that one doesn't have in a more traditional probes. But it's not easy. And it's not only easy, it's not only difficult experimentally, it's difficult numerically. You know, so if you take, you know, theorists who try to solve models on the computer, well, first of all, the models have these horrendous sign problems. So, you know, you can't do quantum Monte Carlo, these frustrated spin models or the Hubbard model or anything. But even if you try to do exact diagonalization studies, you know, so you know the full spectrum of that Hamiltonian, you know, for 36 sites, how do you know what phase you're in? I mean, you can, you know, if you're in one of these algebraic spin liquids, it's, you know, there's sort of no robust, you know, spatially modulated correlator or something you can look at. So it's, you know, it's very, very challenging. But that doesn't mean that these phases are not out there. You know, it's hard. But, you know, okay, that's okay. I mean, it's a good challenge. We need some bright young people to tell us how to do these things. Well, electrons move in three dimensions. Well, three dimensions is interesting. I mean, these topologically ordered phases can exist in three dimensions. So you can have Z2 phases in three dimensions. And in three dimensions, you can have other situations where you have, in addition to particles, you have loops. And you can have phases where, you know, that if you take a particle through a loop, you know, something changes. There's a sign change or something. So there's quite a rich set of possibilities in three dimensions. What I don't know about is whether these critical or algebraic spin liquids can exist in three dimensions. I mean, for those, I don't know if there are any particle physicists in the here, but in high energy physics, one of the real challenges is the so-called hierarchy problem. You know, one has the Planck scale, you know, which is this huge energy scale, and the particles have, you know, very, you know, the particle masses are very, very, very low compared to the Planck scale. And so one has this huge separation of energy scales. And in some sense, one has, you know, the particle mass is, you know, close to being zero compared to the Planck scale. So the theory that describes, you know, the physics of, you know, our vacuum looks like it's fine-tuned to have gapless excitations, to have, you know, arbitrary low-energy excitations. And, you know, so that's a problem. How, you know, in field theory, it looks like you have to tune the mass of the particles to zero. You know, but, you know, why should there be this fine-tuning? Well, the amazing thing about these critical spin liquids or algebraic spin liquids is that the mass is zero, and there's no fine-tuning needed. So it's, in some sense, that within this little world of these two-dimensional electrons, the hierarchy problem would be solved. Now, what I don't know is whether that's, you know, possible to solve it in three dimensions with some sort of three-dimensional spin liquids? My guess is you probably can, but I don't think the theoretical tools that we need to answer that question are really developed enough actually. You know, so basically it's, you know, both two and three dimensions, you know, theoretically things are just, you know, very wide open and blossoming, and, you know, experimentally there's lots of systems out there we don't understand, and, you know, one hopes that, you know, some of these theoretical ideas will find fruition in these materials, and if not, you know, we need to develop some way of thinking about the materials. So, you know, I think it's an exciting but challenging time. And, carbon nanotube in 1D, yeah. What does 1D mean? Well, okay, so 1D, the carbon... Yeah, so a carbon nanotube is just like literally a long tube, right? And so, well, so a carbon nanotube, the wave function around the tube is... just has one wavelength all the way around the tube, and the states with, you know, more than one wavelength going around the tube are at high energies, and are not present in the ground state in some sense. So the only interesting motion of these electrons is up and down the tube, you know. So carbon nanotubes are amazing, you know, systems, both just for their intrinsic theoretical interest and also for the, you know, electrical properties, and perhaps, you know, they might be useful and they're strong and so forth, and, you know, use them for hiding drugs inside them and then, you know, eating them and releasing the drugs. I'm not talking about, you know, coming from Colombia with narcotics, but drug delivery, I think that's what it's called, right? People using these carbon nanotubes, thinking about it. But, so...